طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin today with the ongoing story of Tufts University's attack on Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP. Tufts University's Office for Campus Life hands out awards to student organizations every year, and 2020's Collaboration Award was given to Students for Justice in Palestine. The award is given in recognition of a co-sponsored program that demonstrates synergy and success as a result of working together. SJP earned the award by building a coalition of over 20 student groups to help end collaboration between the school's police force and the Israeli military. In 2017, Tufts University's police chief Kevin McGuire traveled to Israel with a delegation of police officers to attend a counter-terrorism seminar. That caused quite an uproar. There was a letter from faculty members condemning the trip, and a petition went around calling on Tufts to stop partaking in these anti-terrorism trips to Israel. Tufts SJP member Molly Tunis told the school's newspaper, quote, "Obviously, Kevin McGuire is just one small piece of the puzzle. But creating these exchanges and building up this country's military-industrial complex can really have big repercussions, and it really did scare a lot of people on this campus," unquote. Last week, Tufts University President Anthony Monaco and the school's provosts put out a statement condemning the decision to award SJP and effectively claimed that it was an attack on the school's Jewish students. He wrote, and I quote, "We strongly disapprove of this award in light of SJP's policy positions, including its association with the BDS movement, elements of which we view as anti-Semitic. We will be reviewing the awards process, which currently does not involve academic deans or senior university leadership, and this year did not include students, in order to ensure proper oversight and review going forward. We as senior leaders take responsibility for this outcome, which should not have happened, and recognize that the award has caused a great deal of pain and concern for Jewish members of our community and others who share concerns about SJP's policy positions, particularly in light of rising anti-Semitism in the United States and around the world," unquote. A number of pro-Israel organizations, such as the Anti-Defamation League and B'nai B'rith, immediately jumped on board to praise this statement. Tufts SJP and a number of other student organizations published a response to Monaco's statement on the group's Facebook page. Quote, "We are appalled and saddened that Tufts SJP has been falsely accused of anti-Semitism for our principled work supporting Palestinian human rights. It is extremely disheartening to see the Tufts administration push forward these harmful and baseless narratives, both for Arab students in our club, who remain constant targets of racist accusations and baseless smear campaigns that delegitimize their organizing efforts, and for the Jewish students and organizations involved in this campaign, whom this statement entirely erases. Unquote. Tufts SJP is asking people to email school administrators to support them. We know of several that have been written, and I would like to read one of them, sent by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine. It was drafted by one of its members, Nancy Murray. Quote, "Dear President Monaco and Tufts University officials, the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine is a Massachusetts-based organization that raises awareness about Israel's discriminatory water policies and has Tufts alumni among its members. Having long been appreciative of the technical support in water matters that Tufts has given to West Bank refugee camps, we were greatly taken aback to learn of the statement you issued deploring the granting of the university's collaboration award. Having long been appreciative of the technical support in water matters that Tufts has given to West Bank refugee camps, we were greatly taken aback to learn of the statement you issued deploring the granting of the university's collaboration award to the Students for Justice in Palestine. You state that you disapprove of the award, quote, in light of SJP's concerning policy positions, including its association with the BDS movement, elements of which we view as anti-Semitic, unquote. Which elements exactly? And how do you define anti-Semitism in this context? It is regrettable that the leadership of a major U.S. university should be taken in by a well-funded campaign to criminalize a nonviolent human rights movement utilizing peaceful, time-honored tactics to pressure Israel to comply with international law, end its occupation, and recognize Palestinian rights. Boycotts, as you surely know, have a long history in this country and are constitutionally protected. What you may not know is that the BDS movement opposes all forms of segregation, inequality, and discrimination. It has been smeared as anti-Semitic in the effort to perpetuate Israel's control of Palestinian land and lives. We can well understand why Tufts University students, especially students of color and Arab and Palestinian students, do not want their campus police to be trained by a paramilitary force for whom racial profiling holds a paramount role. Rather than condemning the SJP for organizing a campus-wide campaign to end these training programs, university officials should be commending them for building bridges among student groups in order to ensure that Tufts is a safe and inclusive space for all. We have no doubt that the SJP would be in the forefront of opposing incidents involving genuine anti-Semitism were they to occur on campus. They are owed an apology. Sincerely, Nancy Murray, PhD, on behalf of the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine. Unquote. We hope you will join in this campaign to support SJC by writing to Anthony Monaco, president of Tufts University, to challenge his administration's discriminatory action. And now on to our feature presentation, which today is a recording of a conversation with Israeli historian Ilan Pape and Maha Rad of Kinder USA, where they discuss the current situation in Gaza and throughout the West Bank during the COVID-19 pandemic. We begin with Maha Rad outlining the work of Kinder USA in Gaza.
Hello, everyone. I'm Maha Awad with Kinder USA. And firstly, I want to thank you so much for joining us for the first of our Ramadan speaker series this evening. We'll be doing it the next Saturday and the following one after that at the same time. We hope you enjoy our conversation today with Dr. Ilan Pape. And first, let me tell you very quickly why we're doing this. Every year, Kinder USA typically has a fundraising iftar during Ramadan so that we can raise as much as possible for the Ramadan programs that we do that make a huge difference in the neediest children's lives in Gaza. This year, obviously, we're unable to have our iftar due to the circumstances. And so we wanted to not forget those children and their families. Kinder's Ramadan programs provide countless opportunities for female heads of household, needy farmers, unemployed youth, local vendors, and they all benefit from your generosity. The ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza affects every aspect of society, with over 80% of the population relying on assistance and 70% food insecurity, 400,000 of whom are children. Now, our goal this Ramadan is to reach 2,500 families in 15 of the most marginalized areas of Gaza. As always, we try and help as many families as funding permits. Last year, we were able to reach 3,200 families, so we'd love for you to help us reach that number again. And what you have to do, obviously, is go to kinderusa.org and donate and help us reach our goals. Just to give you a really quick idea about the programs, the first one is the Farmers Program, where we give seedlings to 100 small farmers, and then they cultivate the lands, and then we buy the fresh produce from them to use for the food baskets. So rather than giving just, you know, dry food baskets to people, we try to make sure they get fresh produce and so on. We also empower 34 female heads of households through the income generating program, where they're trained to breed chickens for egg laying and for roosting. And then we buy those chickens and those eggs and put them in the food baskets that are given out. And we're also working with 40 women preparing dates, mamoul and jam, also to be put in the food baskets. And basically, this is, like I said, to make sure that when the families receive these baskets, that they have fresh produce, 8 or 10 different kinds of locally grown vegetables. They have jam, they have mamoul, they have chickens and eggs, which sometimes they don't get throughout the entire year. And what's crazy is $130 can feed a family for the entire month of Ramadan. So obviously, any amount is always welcome. But just to keep that in mind, anything from $1 to $1 million we will take. But it just helps, I think, to put it in perspective and realize how far and how long $130 will go. And obviously the need is great, but Kinder is doing the best that we can, and there's always families who need more. So please reach into your pockets, donate, help us reach what we are trying to do, and help us increase these programs for the neediest children and their families that tend to fall through the cracks of the bigger programs. And now I would like to introduce our guest. I'm very excited about our conversation. Professor Ilan Pape is an expatriate Israeli historian and social activist. He is a professor with the College of Social Sciences and International Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK, director of the university's European Center for Palestine Studies, and co-director of the Exeter Center for Ethnopolitical Studies. He's written numerous books and articles, maybe the most well-known of which is The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and his most recent book, 10 Myths About Israel. Professor Pape, I welcome you to our conversation. I'm really excited to have you here with us today.
It's a great pleasure and a great honor to do this for Kinder and for the children of Gaza. And thank you for having me in your program.
Professor, let's start and talk a little bit. I mean, obviously, these are such crazy times that the entire world is experiencing. And, you know, we don't often think about what's going on in the situation in Gaza, given the coronavirus pandemic. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes. The situation in Gaza so far, thank God, is not as bad as we thought it would be, but it still has the potential of becoming disastrous. Mm-hmm. Gaza, in a cynical way, because Gaza is so blocked and sieged, mm-hmm. There was no entry of people who had the virus from China or from any other part of the world. And therefore, one thinks that at least at this stage, the spread of the virus is more limited. The mm-hmm. problem is that we know how quickly this virus spreads and can spread. And the most worrying and the most kind of really cruel side of the story is that whatever would happen there depends on the goodwill of Israel. And there's mm-hmm. no goodwill on the part of Israel. So, mm-hmm. for example, you cannot know the number of people who were infected by the virus unless you do the testing, as you all know, in the United States. Now, these testing can only be done in Israel, and Israel conditions the testing on extracting political and other concessions from the Hamas government in Gaza, and actually sees it as part of its siege policy. Mm-hmm. Now, any outbreak of the virus in a larger kind of span, which doesn't have to be on the level of that you have in the U.S., every such increase will collapse the health infrastructure in Gaza, which is already working under impossible conditions. In fact, had it not been for the improvisation of and the amazing tenacity of the doctors there, the system would have not have operated at all. So it's very precarious. And it should be seen within the wider context of a society that is on the brink of human catastrophe at any moment. And definitely the outbreak of the virus does not help that.
Mm-hmm. I was reading even to your point, in addition to not enough testing to be able to really find out how many people in Gaza are infected, even the communications, there's not a lot of them in Arabic. So all the things that would normally be given out to people to let them know the precaution and so on are not being translated into Arabic, correct?
Absolutely. I would add to this another issue, of course, that we all understand that social distancing is one of the major measures that the World Health Organization recommends as a way of dealing with this challenge. Now, the density in Gaza is the highest in the world. So you can imagine that on top of it, it's even difficult to exercise even a minimal social distancing. And this adds to this apprehension that at any given moment, this could really become much worse. But thank God it hasn't happened yet. But we have to be very alert about it. And of course, talk about the inhumanity that is still being exercised while the rest of the world at least tries to talk about human solidarity and forgetting about conflicts and other issues for the sake of our health. This is not the situation in the Strip.
Mm-hmm. Professor, I want to step back a little bit. One of the things that I know you wanted to talk about today, which we definitely want to hear about, maybe step a little bit away from the virus just for a few minutes, but the issue of Palestine at large under the Trump administration since Trump has taken office. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. Yes, it's very important to talk about it, because I think that under Trump, and especially due to the alliance that he has with the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the mm-hmm. Palestinians in general are under an assault. In fact, I think this is one of the most difficult moments since 1948 in this respect, not because we are facing the similar catastrophe that befell the Palestinians in the Nakba, but because there is a similar intent behind the Trump and Netanyahu policies that is reminds us of the Zionist policy in 1948. And that intent is to depoliticize the Palestine issue. If you look at the Trump deal of the century, which we should really call steal of the century. And if you look at the measures that this administration took before the deal was publicized, the transition of the embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, recognizing the settlements, recognizing Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights, and recently recognizing the Jewish settlements in the West Bank and the right of Israel to annex a large part of the West Bank. If you look at all of this as part of the same strategy, you can see that the whole idea is to, and this came out in the deal, the whole idea is to say there is no political issue in Palestine anymore. There's only a humanitarian issue that can be solved by a business-like approach. We need to inject some money into this, but you can allow Israel to be in control over the whole of Palestine. The Palestinians would give up their political demands, their right for self-determination, the right for return, and would have some improvement in their living conditions. And that would mean you wipe out the Palestinians and the Palestine issue from history and from the present reality. I would just add to this something that people should note. This goes along with Israeli actions, which are parallel to the Trump administration. The Israeli nationality law from the end of 2018, the Israeli decision not to allow any access to the documentation that records the Israeli actions during the Nakba, and of course the Israeli decision to annex the Jordan Valley. If you take all these together with the other known policies, again, it's the same idea. It's an attempt to wipe out Palestine as a political issue, as a national issue, to wipe out the Palestinians from history, and by that declaring the end of the conflict, so to speak. It will not work, but it's very worrying that a huge superpower like the United States is behind this act of elimination, which we all should challenge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for giving us that insight. And another thing I was reading as well today is that there are, given the pandemic, it's actually kind of opening up a path for more annexation. I think I saw a quote today that said, with no international restraint on Israel and Palestine and Palestinian protests severely hindered under emergency coronavirus orders, there is little stopping it from proceeding with annexation. So, you know, coming kind of a little bit further forward to during the pandemic, how is the current situation aiding the plan that you just talked about?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it does. It's the whole idea behind Israeli policies today is unilateralism, unilateral actions. They want, they have given up on the idea that they have to negotiate with anyone or to get any kind of legitimacy for what they are doing. And you're absolutely right. They use the fact that the Palestinians cannot demonstrate, cannot reject, and that the international community is distracted by this whole global crisis. They use it to accelerate the process of annexation, to continue the oppression of anyone within the West Bank, for instance, or the greater Jerusalem area that dares to reject them. And as we speak, demolition of houses, taking over land, and even the sort of cruel crime of hebricide and taking over the water resources of the people in the Jordan Valley in the south of Mount Hebron, Halil, is continuing with great kind of energy on the Israeli side, because they feel that they have this window of opportunity as long as the crisis goes on. And as you know, Maha, it's very difficult to get the attention of people who usually are willing to join us in the struggle against the colonization, the dispossession, and the ethnic cleansing. It's very difficult these days to attract their attention and get their support, because they all feel, come on, there's something more important. Mm-hmm. But actually, there isn't. The virus would go away eventually, and we will deal with it. But some of the actions, the inhuman actions of the Israelis, are irreversible. And we really owe it to the Palestinians not to forget this, even at the height of this medical crisis we are all facing.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, your point is so valid and important. I think that, you know, we all tend to forget, and I mean, the media cycle moves so quickly, and there is such a focus right now on the pandemic and on, you know, the coronavirus crisis, that it is really easy. People have such a short attention span. You know, like you said, even people who normally would care very much are more, think of this as a more kind of imminent issue going on, while actually, like you said, this will pass. And this, the crisis going on in Palestine and in Gaza is going to continue. And as a matter of fact, while we're not looking, it's like you said, it's actually getting worse. So can we talk a little specifically about the Strip as well, about the Gaza Strip? Because, you know, we talked a little bit about the Israeli policy in general, but I want to talk specifically about the Strip because, I mean, the circumstances there are so very specific, and it's so different than anywhere else because of the siege and because it's so blocked off from everywhere else.
Yes, definitely. There is a very sad, in a way humorous, but sad cartoon that I saw in one of the newspapers in Gaza. I wish I had the time to send it to you, but I just saw it this morning. You see the coronavirus comforting a man from Gaza and saying to him, "Don't worry, one day this will also pass."
Oh my God.
This is, I think, it embodies exactly what you were asking about, this particular circumstances where actually the 5-stars lockdown that most people experience in the world, the social distancing, the all kinds of impositions from above that people find very hard to deal with, it's a daily experience in Gaza, actually, but not in such a comfortable within such comfortable conditions, circumstances. It's far harsher than what most people in the world experience as lockdown, as we know. And this has been going on since 2006. We have to remember, we are already entering the 14th year of creating this huge ghetto by sieging it from land, air, and sea. And part of the policy is sometimes to use starvation and to prevent essential commodities, essential medicines, essential material that is needed for just basic life is part of the siege policy in order to pressure the people of Gaza to accept what Israel demands of them. I don't think we have nowadays anywhere in the world that is even similar in, you know, in the mildest way to what we see in Gaza. It's quite incredible how the people there show steadfastness and succeed to survive against all odds. But as we said at the beginning of the conversation, this is very precarious. This can change at any given moment. There is a very severe report by the United Nations that in fact identified this year, 2020, as the most crucial year in the history of the Strip, saying that given all that is going on there, the lack of medical infrastructure, the lack of commodities, the mental impact of the siege, given all that reality, they believe that after 2020, this will unfold as a human catastrophe, and unless the world intervenes now in 2020. So I think it's important for everyone of us to study the reports which NGOs are sending from within Gaza to understand what it does mean for a schoolboy, a schoolgirl, for their parents, how does a kindergarten looks like under such condition? What does it mean to live in such a condition when it comes to hospitals, any other public services, so that the daily reality that we are just tasting some of it due to the coronavirus is something far worse and has been going on, as I said, for about 14 years. This is something that it's an inhumanity that you probably understand best if you read the reports and talk to people there. And then I don't think anyone can remain indifferent, even at a time like this.
Mm-hmm. Professor, thank you so much for bringing that up, because I mean, it is so easy to, you know, kind of complain or be a little bit indignant about the things that are imposed upon us right now, the stay-at-home orders and this and that, and the shortage of maybe different products and so on, and to forget that these people have lived like this and much worse, actually, as you said, for coming up on 14 years. And I think that those reports definitely are an important thing to be shared and for people to be aware of what it's like really on the ground. Stepping away from the strip a little bit, I want to talk about the Israeli policy towards East Jerusalem and the West Bank. I know that you you wanted to tell us stuff about that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. If I just may, before I move to East Jerusalem in a minute, I just forgot to mention, I think people should be aware of it. In the last month, Israel has intensified two policies which are really callous and cruel and should be noted. One is spraying from the air with pesticides the Palestinian fields. I mean, Gaza as it is doesn't have enough food, but now the situation is far worse because of this use of chemicals, herbicides, to destroy fields. And the second policy that we should be aware of is shooting at fishermen. And again, the fish from the sea is one of the few source of living for people there, also as a food material. Let me move to East Jerusalem in particular. East Jerusalem is also a very dense area. And there, the cynical reality is that Israel officially annexed that area. So theoretically, these people should be receiving the same treatment as the rest of the Israeli citizens, proper testing, proper hospital admission, and everything that one should say. Israel is doing quite well for its Jewish population, but none of it is happening in East Jerusalem. And again, this is part of this idea of the Israelis that they can use a crisis like this in order to pressure a community under occupation and under colonization to be domiciled, to accept its imposition, and to condition it by basic medical aid that Israel is has to provide according to any international law. This is nothing new, by the way. People in the West Bank will tell you that when they needed to rush to a hospital, when a mother was about to rush to hospital to give birth because of complications and so on, at the checkpoint, some of these services would be conditioned by the willing to collaborate, to inform, or any other, they would extract any other quid pro quo for this humanitarian help. Now, what is happening in East Jerusalem, the same is happening as it happens in the checkpoint, but on a larger scale. And I say this is particularly indicative for all of us, because these are supposedly people that Israel now regards as citizens, not people who are under occupation. And many more Palestinians are going to find themselves in this situation if the Trump and Israeli plan to annex large parts of the West Bank is going to materialize. So you will have, again, supposedly Palestinians who've become Israeli citizens, but would be treated in the same way as the people of East Jerusalem would be, kind of a citizenless citizenship, which in times of crisis could be existential. This is on top of what we have talked before, that Israel uses the international distraction or the fact that the international community is not focused now on East Jerusalem to continue the demolition of houses, the expropriation of houses for Jewish colonization, and intensifies is Judaization for a process in Greater Jerusalem under this shadow of the virus and the world's indifference because of it.
So speaking about this notion of kind of second class citizenship and so on, another point that you wanted to talk about, which I think is very important, is the impact of that on Arab-Jewish relationships inside Israel.
Yes. Yes. There's something very interesting. The number of Palestinian citizens in the Israeli health system is much larger than their percentage in the population. And their number, and I'm talking about all fields within the health institutions, from the most senior physicians to the people who's doing the unskilled work in hospitals. The number of Palestinians is very high in every level. And in fact, many Israeli Jews owe their life to Palestinian doctors since this outbreak has begun. And there is a potential here, of course, to humanize the Palestinians in the eyes of the Israelis. But the discourse of the government is still as racist as it was before the outbreak of the virus. And therefore, this gap between the reality and the way it is represented by official Israel is deepening. And widening. And it really depends more here on the civil society and people with modicum of decency to understand, if they haven't understood it until now, that they need to take or to adopt a human approach to the issue of the relationship between Arabs and Jews, and not the racist, ideological, Zionist one that the government coaches them to take. It would be very interesting to see if this reality that nobody can deny, that Israeli Jews rely so much on the help of Palestinians within the health system, would change a little bit the racist nature of the Jewish society and its attitudes. I'm not very hopeful. I don't think it would be enough, but it's sometimes it's kind of a ray of hope to show that maybe there's something there we can work on. But we will continue our work of educating people here against racism, against discrimination, as much as we can, of course.
Mm-hmm. Before I move on to the next question, I just want to ask you, why do you think that is, or do you know the reason why there is such a disproportionately large number of Palestinians working within the health system?
Yes, Palestinians are like any minority, are very educated, very ambitious personally in pursuing careers that are open to them. Mm-hmm. A lot of the professions in Israel, which are related to high tech, are closed in the name of national security. So Palestinians are pushed to certain professions by the racist policy of employment in Israel. Mm-hmm. And there is a quota on Israeli medical schools. So Palestinians cannot finish their medical schools or go to medical schools in Israel in large numbers. So they go abroad, mainly to Italy, Romania, and other places. But what happens is that Israeli Jewish doctors find the pay and the pressure too much, and many of them are in the United States now. So there's a vacuum which is filled by a large number of Palestinians. I think one of the Palestinian towns, Arabe, in the Galilee, has the largest number of persons of doctors in the world. So it's quite the... And maybe it's something positive for the future. You know, it's about healing. It's about getting better and healthier, and not giving up in a situation where the cards are against you. You are oppressed. You're being discriminated against, and yet you keep your posture. I see it also part of steadfastness, or sumur, as we say in Arabic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I applaud your optimism. I mean, given everything that, you know, we were just, that we've been talking about and how disheartening the picture is, I mean, I think it's important and so valuable to have a little bit of hope and optimism and positivity, as you were just saying. So I hope we can all have that. The last thing I want to ask you about is the effect of all this on the Palestinian Authority. I mean, obviously everything that's going on is taking a toll on their ability to do what they need to do.
Absolutely. On the one hand, one should say that at least in the areas where they control, and we all should remember that they have limited control geographically in the West Bank. They don't control the whole of the West Bank, only 40% of the West Bank. And even within that 40%, they rule directly only 50% of it. So we should think about it more as a big municipality rather than the government of a state. And that also explains its limited possibilities with dealing with the virus without, again, the Israeli infrastructure behind it. Within the condition that they're working in, I think they did quite a good job, relatively speaking, one should say that. But it exposes something more fundamental, of course. And this is the fact that Israel is going to create, if it hadn't already created, a big apartheid state between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. So actually, there is one state now in Palestine. There are no two states, and it's very difficult to see in the future the creation of two states. So what we have is one apartheid state that rules the Palestinians through different means. And one of the means is the kind of relationship it has with the PA. And this cannot go on for too long, I think. This is where the future will determine how the Palestinians would react to this new reality. As you know, we have this very interesting situation in Palestine and among Palestinians in the world. The people who represent authentically the Palestinian national movement nowadays still believe strongly, or at least claim that they believe strongly in the two-state solution. Mm-hmm. The electorate, the Palestinians electorate, wherever it is, it doesn't matter, stopped believing in that solution and believes that actually we have to go back to the struggle that was until the 1980s for a democratic state for everyone, Jews and Arabs. And the return of the refugees. It would be interesting to see how the Palestinian national movements, not just the PA, moves into the future with the new program for the liberation of Palestine, which is adapted to the 21st centuries, to the realities of the 21st centuries. We all remember that Palestinian is one of the youngest societies in the world. And the young people have a different way of doing things, different thing of envisioning the future. I think the PA and many other things are something that will not be with us for very long. And it would be very interesting to see how the younger Palestinian generation would lead us all, hopefully for a better future, because they are facing, of course, a very cruel enemy and an international coalition that still has not digested the catastrophe that befell the Palestinians in 1948 and ever since.
You have been listening to historian Ilan Pape and Maha Rad of Kinder USA discussing Palestine in the time of COVID-19. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.